Now, we want to warn you the following conversation includes discussion of sexual issues and rape. It may not be suitable for all listeners. Use your discretion. Last year, at least 15 on-campus rapes were reported at the University of Georgia in Athens. And as a nation, we're having more very tough conversations about sexual violence and harassment as more women step forward to accuse powerful men of abusing their positions. We have profilers for killers and terrorists, but what about people who are likely to commit assault and rape? Is there a profile? Kevin Swartout is Associate Professor of Psychology and Public Health at Georgia State University. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Catherine Jungt, a sociologist with Emory University. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
So, Kevin, let's start about on the psychology of someone who might engage in a sexually abusive act. Why do so many mental health professionals say it's not about sex?
Well, it is about sex to a certain extent, but it's about a lot more than sex. We know that there are some factors that put men, especially young men, at higher risk for perpetrating sexual violence or sexual assault. Having a lot of impersonal sex is one of those factors. But another factor that's just as important, if not more important, is their levels of hostility toward women. The social networks they hang out with, are their peers supportive of sexual violence? Do their peers engage in sexual violence? And also, there's a large substance use component to it. We know that alcohol use is involved in a majority of at least campus sexual assaults by either the victim, the perpetrator, or both. So there's a lot of factors, but it is, to a certain extent, about sex.
So, Catherine, part of the reason we have discussions like this is because we're trying to prevent it, right? How does a better understanding of someone who might engage in this kind of behavior, how does that help us prevent future assaults and harassment?
That's a great question, and I wanted to lend my support to the risk factors that our colleague mentioned. I also wanted to mention another important piece of this, and that is to recognize that the perpetration of sexual violence can also come from experiences of trauma and violence in childhood. And I think our research has borne out that sometimes high percentages of men are exposed to child maltreatment, interparental violence, peer bullying, gang violence, etc. And so prevention programs would do well to understand the potential trauma that men have been exposed to as a possible determinant. Another thing that I think is really important is to understand that men are often brought up with certain expectations of masculinity that include stoicism, strength, denial of illness, but also aggression. As a commonly accepted element of men's identity. And so prevention programs also would do well to support positive nonviolent masculinities on college campuses, really as a population-based measure to prevent sexual violence.
Kevin, is there a difference in age in terms of likelihood? We're saying men a lot in this because men are the most likely by far. That doesn't mean women are not also don't also do this, but men are most likely to do it. But is there an age at which a man is most likely to engage in abusive behavior like this? Is it the younger guys? Is guys in their middle age?
To your first point, women can perpetrate sexual violence. Men can be victims of sexual violence. We know that that does happen.
Yeah.
But absolutely, the overwhelming majority of sexual violence and sexual assault is male perpetrated with females as survivors. In terms of the development of sexually violent or assaultive behavior, we know a good amount about adolescence through early adulthood. Once we get into middle and late adulthood, the information we have gets a little bit spotty because a lot of our samples are high school and college samples. We do know that sexually violent behavior does start to manifest in some as early as 14, 15, 16 years old when they're in high school. What's interesting in my research, I find that the young men who are most likely to perpetrate sexual violence and even sexual assault in high school are not the group of guys who are more likely to perpetrate or most likely to perpetrate in college. A lot of guys who perpetrate in high school, once they move to that college environment, for whatever reason, we think it might be alcohol use or peer network factors, they're less likely to continue perpetration. Group of guys who's most likely to perpetrate in college, a series of risk factors hit in college, substance use, negative peers, which increases their risk.
Catherine, is there a particular kind of intervention that is more effective than others? And I'm thinking of things like many universities have started with college courses that teach consent issues, for example. Do we know if there are any that are particularly effective?
There are surprisingly few evidence-based interventions. However, there are some that have demonstrated effectiveness. There are programs that teach, again, positive social norms around masculinity that clarify what real consent means in terms of sexual relationships, and that really try to work with peer networks, as was just described, to promote what we call pro-social bystander behavior. So if an incident that one observes of sexual harassment or other forms of sexual violence is occurring, then men are really encouraged to stand up and speak out in favor of prevention.
How far does that go, though, Catherine? In other words, we've been hearing a lot from men who say they've witnessed at least some sexual harassment in the workplace. Does their speaking up in that situation maybe have an effect on the possibility that it may get worse than that?
I think in general, part of what these programs are trying to do is to really change the culture around sexual relationships and to change the culture around what we accept and we don't accept. And so these strategies really are population-based strategies to try to reach as many men as possible to engage in effective prevention and effective bystander behavior. So that's been the approach that has been supportive in terms of evidence in preventing both incidents of perpetration and pro-social bystander behavior.
You were nodding your head, Kevin, when she was talking about changing a culture. Is that a better strategy? When trying to change a whole culture seems more difficult than changing an individual. Why is it the culture a better strategy?
Yeah, like my colleague mentioned, there haven't been a whole lot of prevention programs that have demonstrated effectiveness in actually reducing perpetration rates. A lot of the prevention programs in the last couple of decades have focused on the individual level, trying to get individuals not to perpetrate.
Victims, telling them.
There is one risk reduction for program for victims out of Canada that is effective, although teaching women not to get raped is somewhat problematic,
yeah.
But... at this point, we need to go with what works. So as Catherine said, the population-based strategies have shown some effectiveness, and it is more of a global approach. But in terms of changing the social norms, it's really interesting in this current dialogue that we're having. Some people find it uncomfortable that several men in Hollywood and in industry
Louis
are being
C.K.
called
and
out.
Harvey Weinstein,
for,
yeah.
Yeah, are getting called out. It's uncomfortable, but that's what it feels like when you change the social norm. So this ultimately, this accountability could help combat sexual harassment and sexual violence because it makes it less normative. There's more perceived sanctions, which we know is actually a protective factor for harassment and violence. If you know you're going to be called out, you're less likely to engage in the behavior.
Catherine, we only have 30 seconds left, and I hate to do this to you, but is there such a thing as rape culture, and are we in one?
There certainly is a thing such as rape culture, and that's part of the norm that that we're trying to change through effective, pro-social, behavioral promotion, and really promoting non-tolerance for non-consensual sex.
That's sociologist Catherine Yungt. She's at Emory University, and she's the Isa Griggs Candler Chair of Global Health. You also heard Kevin Swartout from Georgia State's Department of Psychology and Public Health. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.